and his companions became so hopeful that they could not contain themselves for joy. By looking at this pleasant scene, they got very happy. They were sure that they are the victors.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this work. Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So this is what these people, these wizards said. By Pharaoh's dignity, we shall certainly be the victors. Inna lanahnu al-ghalibun. They talked so certainly that one might wonder that these are the very ones they asked Pharaoh to give them reward if they were successful. فَلَمَّا جَاءَ السَّحَرَةُ قَالُوا لِفِرْعَوْنَ أَإِنَّ لَنَا لَأَجْرًا إِن كُنَّا نَحْنُ الْغَالِبِينَ. Shall we have a reward if we should be the victors? They were not sure whether they will be victors or not. But now, when they see the gathering, when they see the power of their co-workers, they start with the name of this great ruthless oppressor, and like sycophants, they rely on his power and they say that we shall be among the victorious. So they somehow started a kind of psychological war, although they were not sure of their victory in the very beginning. We will talk about the rest of the story in the remaining verses of this chapter, God willing, in the upcoming episodes. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
You're listening to Husseiniya from IRIB English Radio by Sayyid Abbas Rezavian. Labbaik Ya Hussein.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alayka Ya Aba Abdullah. Peace and salutations upon you, O Master of Martyrs, Ya Sayyid al-Shuhada. Today is the day of Ashura. It is the day of lamenting. It is the day of crying. It is the day that our Imam Mahdi, the 12th Imam, cries the most out of anybody else in this world. We talked about benefiting from Ziyarat Ashura, and we talked about the final position which we reach if we incorporate Ziyarat Ashura in our lives, that is reaching Al-Maqam Al-Mahmud, the praiseworthy station, the station of the Prophet, the station of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. It is important for us to know on such a day that when we talk about the station of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, that we don't separate Imam Hussein alayhi salam from Imam Mahdi. On such a day, we need to know that who is the one that is crying the most? Who is the one that is can see what exactly happened to Imam Hussein on this day? It is Imam Mahdi, Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajah. We read in Ziyarat Nahiyah, one of the ziyarats attributed to Imam Mahdi, that he says, فَلْأَنْدُبَنَّكَ صَبَاحًا وَمَسَاءً. I will therefore lament you morning and evening, Imam Hussein. Imam Mahdi says, I'll cry for you day and night. وَلِأَبْكِيَنَّ عَلَيْكَ بَدَلَ الدُّمُوعِ دَمًا. And will weep blood in places of tears. This is haqiqat. This is a reality. He is not metaphorically speaking. Imam Mahdi is crying blood for Imam Hussein. When we look and incorporate this Maqam al-Mahmud, and we say that who has Maqam al-Mahmud right now on this earth, it is Imam Mahdi. And we say that Imam Mahdi's grief and crying is the crying that is accepted. The Quran talks about those that have perseverance and those that have forbearance and those that have patience. And when musibat comes upon them, he gives them reward for this musibah. He gives them reward for this calamity. And there's a verse of the Quran. It says, "Ulaika alayhim salawatun min rabbihim." For those that say, "Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un." Those that say, "Indeed we belong to God and indeed to Him we will return." Salawat of God will be upon them. The salutations of God will be upon them. Min rabbihim wa rahma. And their mercy, His mercy will be upon them. So who deserves the mercy and salutations of Allah the most during this affliction? It is Imam Mahdi. Therefore, we can think of the day of Ashura similar to like the night of Qatr, the night of power, the night of destiny. that when we say all the angels descend, تَنَزَّلُ الْمَلَائِكَ, all the angels descend every year on who? On Imam Mahdi. They bring all the events when they descend to who? To Imam Mahdi. And he is the source and he is the core of Laylatul Qadr. And therefore, when our decrees want to be finalized, it is linked to Imam Mahdi. When we want to connect to God in the night of Qadr, it is linked to Imam Mahdi. In the same way that Imam Mahdi is also the core of the day of Ashura. Because he is the one that is truly grieving. He is the one that is truly sad. He is the one whose azadari or matam or sorrow and crying is accepted. Therefore, whatever blessings Allah is going to give us and the followers of the Ahlul Bayt first goes to Imam Mahdi, ajjalallahu ta'ala faraja, then spreads out to us. Therefore, on the day of Ashura, it is the day that we completely turn our soul and our minds to Imam Mahdi, the true Musab, the true person that has affliction for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. He truly knows what happened to Imam Hussein. If the reality of Ashura were to befall us and we were be able to see it completely how it is, we could not bear it. Only one person can bear Ashura and seeing it truly in this world, and that is Imam Mahdi, ajallahu ta'ala faraja. Therefore, we need to connect to Imam Mahdi on such a day, and we use Imam Hussein and his movement and Ziyarat Ashura. It is a bab, it is a door. We go through the door of Imam Hussein, and through this door, we reach our own Imam, Imam Mahdi. May Allah, inshallah, on such a day, expedite his return and make us of his true and sincere followers, inshallah.
Standing here alone, on a land so far from home, a place where angels cry, while innocent children die. Hussein said goodbye, praying some of them survive the torture and the heat. They can't bear to watch him leave. They cry out, Hussein, ya Hussein.
Today is the day of Ashura. It is the day of grief. It is the day of sorrow. And we're talking about that nobody is as sorrowful and grievous as Imam Mahdi, ajjalallahu ta'ala faraja, on such a day. He is the true Musab. He is the one that the calamity has befell upon him. Because he sees, we hear about Ashura, we read Maqtals, we read the way that Imam Hussein's companions are martyred on such a day, but he sees it, he witnesses it. So our question today is this, is that how can we connect to Imam Mahdi? How can we connect to Imam Hussein on such a day? There's a very famous khutbah. It's called Khutbah of Ma'rifat Binuraniyat, meaning that you have cognition and understanding and knowledge through Nur. It means that there's another faculty of gaining knowledge besides the mind and intellect, that you can gain knowledge through the spirit. You can gain knowledge through Nur and through light. Once Abu Dhar comes in this tradition, comes to Salman of Farsi, and asks him, what is this ma'rifat binuraniyat? What is this understanding and knowledge through Nur? So Salman and Abu Dhar, they approach Imam Ali alayhi salam and they ask him. Imam Ali teaches him and says, Ya Salman wa ya Jundab, which is the name of Abu Dhar, Qala labbaik, we are ready, Ya Amir al-Mu'mineen, we are here. إِنَّهُ لَا يَسْتَكْمِلُ أَحَدٌ الْإِيمَانِ حَتَّى يَعْرِفَنِي كُنْهَ مَعْرِفَةِ بِنُورَانِيَّ. Basically, this is a good question you ask. Nobody will reach the reality of faith unless he attains and recognizes me through Nur. You have to know me through Nur. You have to attain knowledge of me through your spirit. فَإِذَا عَرَفَنِي بِهَذِهِ الْمَعْرِفَةِ فَقَدْ إِمْتَحَنَ اللَّهُ قَلْبَهُ لِلْإِيمَانِ. If God gives somebody and tests him with true faith, gives them this nur, he will be given true faith. You know, his light, his chest will be expounded. Then he tells them this, وَمَنْ قَسَّرَ عَنْ مَعْرِفَةِ ذَلِكَ فَهُوَ شَكٌّ مُرْتَابٌ. And whoever does not understand me through light, he will be in doubt. So brothers and sisters, we are being taught from Imam Adi in this hadith that there's another faculty of realizing and connecting to the Holy Prophet, to the Ahlul Bayt, through Nur and through light. And that is what happens when you go to their ziyarat. That is what is happening on the day of Ashura when you're connecting to him, you're connecting to Imam Mahdi. Then in the tradition it says, Ya Salman, Ya Jundab. And they, again, they say, Labbaik, we are here, we're listening, we're ready for you. Ya Amir al-Mu'mini, O Commander of the Faithful. Ma'rifati binuraniya ma'rifatullah. Whoever has known me through light has known God. The more you know the Ahlul Bayt, this cognition that you have, you will know Allah. Wa ma'rifatullah ma'rifatani binuraniya. And the more you know Allah, the more you witness him with your spirituality, the more you witness me. وَهُوَ دِينُ الْخَالِصِ. Do you want دِينُ الْخَالِصِ? Do you want pure religion? It is understanding and connecting and having cognition of the Ahlul Bayt through the spirit. That is دِينُ الْخَالِصِ. That is pure religion. So on the day of Ashura, we connect to the true person that is crying for Imam Hussein, that is Imam Mahdi. We connect to Imam Hussein alayhi salam. We connect to the children of Imam Hussein, the companions of Imam Hussein that were martyred on such a day. And we take our spirit and our spirituality to Karbala. And we ask Allah one dua this day. And that is to bring back our Imam and to make us of his true followers and companions, inshallah.
Real Royals. Part 2.
Welcome to the Sailors' Church. I invite you to join me in prayer or to take this moment for personal reflection, to remember all that was beautiful, great and good in the life of
the UK has both historically and contemporaneously prided itself on its tradition of open wills, whereby wills are open to inspection by the public, mostly out of concern to prevent theft and abuse of authority. And yet the royal family has dissented from this long-established national practice by their ability, since 1910, to seal their wills. The untimely death in 1910 of errant Prince Francis, the brother-in-law of King George V, set in stone a tradition which the British royal family jealously guards to this day, the concept and practice of sealed wills. The catalyst for the un-British practice of sealed wills was Prince Francis' erratic, if not reckless, lifestyle, best exemplified by his compulsive gambling and extreme womanizing. In his will, Francis is believed to have left priceless family jewels to one of his more flamboyant mistresses, Ellen Constance, the Countess of Kilmery, with whom he was rumoured to have had an illegitimate child. This significant act of indiscretion and breach of protocol spurred the royal family into action, first by suppressing the will and subsequently reaching out to Ellen Constance with a hefty bribe, £10,000 to be exact, which amounts to £700,000 in today's money. For the past 100 years or so, English courts have upheld the monarchy's demand that wills of its members, in stark contrast to the wills of the general public, should be sealed and, in effect, kept secret in perpetuity. On the few occasions when this self-declared right to secrecy has been challenged in the courts, notably in 2006 by one Robert Brown, who claims he is an illegitimate child of the deceased Princess Margaret, this has been quashed by the Queen's judges. The precedent set by the suppression of the will of Prince Francis, above all, demonstrates that the British legal system, rooted firmly in the principles of English law, never flinches when it comes to accommodating the whims and fancies of the monarchy. This was in evidence, most recently, in the aftermath of the demise of Elizabeth Angela Marguerite Bowes Loyne, also known as the Queen Mother, who died in March 2002.
A mother, a mum, the Queen Mum.
In keeping with royal tradition, established in 1910 in the wake of Prince Francis's demise, the Queen Mother's will was sealed up on the orders of the High Court, which means that on present trajectory, in view of the total hegemony of the monarchy, it is closed to inspection and publication in perpetuity. The blanket secrecy surrounding royal wills is central to the secrecy in which they conduct all their personal affairs. From wealth accumulation to the conduct of sordid affairs and other scandalous relationships, the case of Diana's husband, Prince Charles, speaks volumes. Diana's husband and her heir to the throne, who is no stranger to sordid and secret affairs. Charles's most infamous escapades was with his childhood sweetheart, Camilla Parker Bowles, with whom he started a secret affair in 1986, 5 years after his marriage with Diana. This is the same Prince Charles whose love for hunting animals is equal to, if not excessive of, his love for human flesh. An avid fox hunter, Charles once famously said he would not stop hunting foxes in the British countryside until the practice was made illegal. Fox hunting was made illegal in the UK in November 2004, and while it is not known if Prince Charles partakes in these illegal hunts, it is well known that for years he lobbied former Prime Minister Tony Blair to repeal the ban. By all credible accounts, Charles's brother Andrew is more morally compromised, as evidenced by his long-standing relationship with the deceased American pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. Prince Andrew, or the Duke of York to use his formal title, is the quintessential royal playboy, as demonstrated by his long list of romantic entanglements, even after his ill-fated marriage to Sarah Ferguson in 1986. Beginning in 1980, the Duke of York has conducted affairs with an astonishing number of glamorous women, including the former playboy model Courtney Love, reality TV star Caroline Stanbury, and the American photographer and actress Koo Stark. Andrew's wife of 10 years, the notoriously volatile Sarah Ferguson, was also no stranger to scandal and sordid affairs. Her immoral and carefree lifestyle exploded onto the public domain after photos of her lounging by the pool with her financial advisor, the Texan millionaire John Bryan, kissing and sucking her toes were published. However, what the British public sees in the way of royal scandals, which erupt onto the public sphere from time to time, is merely the tip of the proverbial iceberg. Plenty of dodgy dealings take place behind the scenes, which the public never hears about as the monarchy's ironclad secrecy, enforced by the courts and broader machinery of state, shows no sign of relenting. The British monarchy exerts influence from behind the scenes in a carefully choreographed effort to present the British system as a parliamentary democracy, with minimal interference in the nation's day-to-day affairs by the Queen. But like everything else in modern Britain, appearances can be deceptive. Even the most intrinsic feature of modern government, namely legislation. On the surface, the process of legislation in the UK is undertaken by both the Houses of Parliament and the government of the day, playing a central role in introducing proposed legislation in the form of bills. But the monarch plays an influential role both at the beginning and end of the legislative process through the Queen's consent and assent. With the former signifying the sovereign's agreement with parliamentary debate on a proposed piece of legislation, and the latter marking the sovereign's seal of approval to a bill that has successfully completed the parliamentary process.
Grateful, and I think my views on this are pretty well understood.
Indeed, a bill only becomes an act, or law of the land, once it has been granted royal assent by the Queen. It might be argued that none of this dissents in a fundamental way from the principles of constitutional monarchy insofar as the sovereign is expected to play a symbolic role in the legislative process. But nothing could be further from the truth. As the Queen actively employs her power of withholding consent for proposed legislation, often in concert with and the active collusion of a sitting government. This often occurs when a sitting government wants to stop proposed legislation which originates from the inner circles of policymaking. Therefore, briefing the Queen and persuading her to withhold her consent from the bill, to be even discussed in Parliament, is the most effective way of stopping inconvenient proposed legislation in its tracks. In keeping with the British tradition of secrecy, records are not kept as to how many times the Queen has exercised her power to withhold consent from proposed legislation entering the parliamentary fray.
In the House of Peers.
But the public know of at least three occasions. The Titles Bill, 1964. The Rhodesia Independence Bill, 1969. And the Military Action Against Iraq Bill, 1999. On all three occasions, the bills were proposed by backbenchers in the House of Commons, and on all three occasions, the sitting government quashed the initiatives by way of persuading the Queen to intervene.
That her attack on the BBC.
In fact, whereas the UK is continually at pains to project itself as the world's leading parliamentary democracy, with Parliament supposedly acting as the will of the people, the truth is that an unelected sovereign plays a central role in the legislative process, both in passive and active capacities. In February 2021, The Guardian revealed that more than 1,000 laws have been vetted by the Queen or Prince Charles through a secretive procedure before they were approved by the UK's elected members of Parliament. The huge number of laws subject to royal vetting cover matters ranging from justice, social security, pensions, race relations, and food policy, through to obscure rules on car parking charges and hovercraft. The wealth of the royal family in terms of fixed assets is concentrated in two crown bodies, the Duchy of Lancaster and Duchy of Cornwall. The Duchy of Lancaster is by far the most consequential, as it constitutes the private estate of the sovereign Queen Elizabeth II. The Duchy of Cornwall, meanwhile, belongs to the eldest son of the reigning monarch, which currently is Prince Charles. These holdings, or crown bodies, to use British political jargon, merely represents the vast estates, including palaces, that belong to the royal family and which the state upkeeps with taxpayers' money. But the Queen's wealth, as well as other leading members of the royal family, exceeds the value of the buildings and lands held by the two duchies. As far back as 2001, the Mail on Sunday calculated that the Queen was worth £1.15 billion, with her vast investment portfolio worth £500 million alone. The Queen reportedly is an avid collector of expensive and exotic items. Her collection alone was worth an eye-watering £100 million. But as faithful as he was to the pertinent facts, Hall's description was, by all credible accounts, an underestimate. In 2017, the Paradise Paper leak revealed that millions of pounds from the private estate of Britain's Queen Elizabeth II had been invested in offshore tax haven funds. The royal family doesn't have to pay a single penny for the upkeep of the vast estates under their control. And needless to say, members of the royal household don't pay a single penny in income tax either. Or any other form of tax, for that matter. And that's just the beginning, as the royal family receives a more than generous stipend from the state to maintain their lavish lifestyles, all at the expense of the out-of-pocket British taxpayer. The current legislative framework for funding the lifestyle and expenses of the royal family is embodied in the Sovereign Grant Act 2011, which replaced the civil list mechanism established by King George III in 1760. On the face of it, the new arrangement is advantageous to the monarchy, as income from the old civil list in the years 2001 to 2011 was fixed at £7.9 million annually. By contrast, in 2012, the new sovereign grant scheme funneled an exorbitant £1 million into the pockets of the royal household. In the year 2018 to 2019, this had increased to a staggering £82.8 million, and by all accounts, it is set to rise by at least 8 to 10% annually for the foreseeable future. To place financial arrangements on a more favourable footing, the royals could always rely on the Tory party, which had for the past 180 years, since its foundation in the 1830s, championed the cause of monarchy as part of its broader right-wing political and ideological agenda. If Parliament were a school. When the Conservative Party came to power following the May 2010 general election, albeit as part of a coalition government with the Liberal Democrats, they quickly set about abolishing the civil list arrangement of 1760. The then Tory Chancellor, George Osborne, contrived a scheme, doubtless in close consultation with the Queen and her son Prince Charles, which would replace the 1760 deal with a new arrangement whereby a percentage of the profits of the Crown Estate would be diverted to royal accounts. This was initially set at 15% of profits annually, but has subsequently been increased to 25% to cover a bells and whistles upgrade to Buckingham Palace. Osborne and the Tories went the extra mile to please the Queen and her eldest son. For, as part of the new deal, if income from the Crown Estates fell one year, the royals would be compensated for the loss. And vice versa, in the event of above-inflation income stream, the royals get to pocket the excess. The arrangement of 2011 has all the trappings of placing the royal family above the vicissitudes of the British economy. Despite its massive constitutional significance and considerable financial implications, information about this new arrangement was kept to a small circle within the government. it was rushed through a small committee in the House of Commons, with only the Scottish National Party objecting to its terms.
This is almost the kind of behaviour we would expect to see in the Duma in Moscow.
To make matters worse, the draft legislation was personally delivered to Prince Charles by the pliant Tory Chancellor Osborne so that the Queen's eldest son could issue his consent to the proposed legislation. Britain is not an anomaly in Europe in terms of having a monarchy. Excluding the UK, there are 9 monarchies left in Europe. But what sets the European monarchies apart from Britain's royal family is their genuine and robust constitutional status, in addition to multiple layers of oversight exercised over them to prevent abuse of power and privilege. For example, under Article 19 of the Norwegian Constitution, in order for the king to accede to the throne, he has to make the following pledge. I promise and swear that I will govern the Kingdom of Norway in accordance with the Constitution. Similarly, Article 32 of the Dutch Constitution requires that the king shall swear or promise allegiance to the Constitution and that he will faithfully discharge his duties. The remaining monarchies in Europe are truly constitutional, insofar as they are subordinate to the policies which they purport to represent. By stark contrast, the British monarchy stands not only above democracy, but above the law itself. Indeed, they like to think they are the law, inasmuch as they do whatever they please, including accumulating wealth without paying a penny in tax. Seen in this context, the British royal family constitutes Europe's largest imperial monarchy, apparently impervious to the vicissitudes of politics and history. It doesn't stop there, as even their upkeep far exceeds that of their European counterparts. The decadence and greed of the British monarchy puts European monarchies, indeed monarchies across the world, to shame. As for palaces, for example, the Spanish, Dutch and Danish royal families each have access to only 2 palaces. The House of Windsor, meanwhile, occupies 15 state residences, and that figure excludes privately owned estates like Balmoral Castle and Sandringham House. Monarchies around the world are adapting fast to political developments, if only to ensure their survival in an age of forensic scrutiny. Japan, which credibly claims to be the oldest monarchy in the world, is leading the way by trying to create as much distance as possible between the royal family and public expenditure. Prince Akishino, who is next in line to succeed Emperor Naruhito, announced that the royal family should cover the expense of succession ceremony from its own funds, as opposed to relying on the state treasury to cover the costs. This is a world away from the dreamscape occupied by Queen Elizabeth II, her heirs and entourage. Despite their vast wealth, the royals make liberal use of public resources for their own pleasure and comfort. For instance, Prince William, who many believe will be the next king as Charles may abdicate in favour of his oldest son, once used a military helicopter to fly to a stag party. By the same token, the royals are not shy of using fabulously wealthy people's private resources either. In 2018, the American actor and producer George Clooney treated Prince Harry and his wife Meghan Markle to a decadent holiday in Italy. Clooney reportedly flew the royal couple there in his private jet and gave them unfettered access to his luxurious 25-room villa. The question is, what, if anything, Clooney got in return for his extraordinary generosity? When the scandal about the couple's pension for private jets first broke out, some observers were puzzled as to why the singer and songwriter Elton John had been so keen to leap to Harry and Meghan's defense. The answer may lie in the fact that the royal family uses its wealth and privilege to cultivate famous and influential types, exactly for such occasions when it needs to polish up its public image. Modern Britain is a country of contrasts, not to mention deep contradictions. The dizzyingly complex mix of traditions, mores, and an apparently insatiable postmodern impulse has created a country that is hard to decipher, let alone fully understand. And so it is with the monarchy. On the surface, most Britons appear to support the antiquated institution, not just on the grounds of sentimentalism, but also good old-fashioned British pragmatism. And yet, the UK is home to a small but vocal Republican community.
I'm here to protest the unaccountable power of the Crown, what it symbolises, which is hereditary privilege, and the constitutional power that it still has.
We don't need that kind of icon. No, much better icons are, you know, things like ideas like democracy and the equality of citizenship, and maybe someone chosen by us to represent us.
The fact of the matter is, there is no credible evidence or indication even that the British public wants to abolish the monarchy, except for very cosmetic changes to the monarchy and only to placate public anger. Never to reform the monarchy itself. Based on this clear political reality, the British monarchy is set to survive the 21st century, perhaps with little, if any, substantial change. But a parallel development points to the diminution of the UK's role in the world. Perhaps even the breakup of the UK itself, as evidenced by the strengthening independence movement in Scotland and, to a lesser extent, Wales. As Britain becomes more parochial, the rest of the world is likely to care much less about the House of Windsor, and that may be a punishment worse than death for Britain's media-conscious royal family.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss about the problems, questions, and issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Professor Salman Naqvi. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Professor Salman Naqvi is a faculty member at the Al Mustafa University and also a researcher on the Islamic issues in the Hawza Ilmi Afka. Well, talking about the development of relationship with environment, we compared the situation that we are dealing with today, that our children are so much attached to the fantasy world, to the digital world, and this addiction that they have with the digital world has actually detached them from the environment, and which makes them less able to realize the signs of Allah around them in the environment. So you discussed a few points in the previous episode, and we want you to repeat a few of them and tell us new ways. How do we come out of this digital world? And I mean, you clearly explained this, that we need to take out them from this addiction. So once we cannot, I as a mother cannot just tell my child, just give me back the phone, I won't let you play more. I have to provide an alternative. What are those alternatives as for you?
One thing that is very important for us to understand, that we must ourselves understand, that there's no doubt about it. Then when we are talking about the digital world, and we're talking about, for example, the mobile applications and the games, and when we're talking about the mobile itself, the cell phone, it is no doubt, there's no doubt about it, that this technology has been developed by man, by mankind. It is the advancement of the very basic fundamental issues that we believe about in. When we talk about Allah Almighty, and there's an expression in the Quran that on the day of judgment, or generally speaking, the whole of the universe matwiyatum biyamineh.
Okay.
The Quran says the whole of the universe is in his grip of power.
All right.
Is within his clutches. Everything can come down to this. Everything is in his clutches. He controls everything.
Yes.
This mobile set, when you put it in the palm of your hand,
yeah,
it's a manifestation of that superior intellect that is controlling all of this.
Yeah.
And he is the creator of everything. And he has created the human being. Who has created this, which is a manifestation of the signs of Allah Almighty?
Okay, so even if you're giving your children just to play games for a few hours, you can again manifest the signs of Allah.
You can tell him or tell her, your child, look, what you are doing, it is what the human being has done. But
yeah,
the human being has done something what God has done.
Yeah.
God has created us and all what we do.
Yes.
He is the true creator.
Yeah.
So we have to take him back to that. Now, we need him to, instead of saying, oh, look, you're going to play with this, why don't you break it up and make it again?
Yes.
I mean to say that let us inculcate in our children the habit of breaking things up. Of course, I'm not talking about the mobile that is costing maybe so many millions of tumans or whatever.
Yeah.
Or many, many dollars. Even old things. Allow your child to play with them. Open them up.
Okay.
Understand what's there. I mean, even within this world of technology, there are so many gadgets, old things in our house.
So you have to actually push them when they are indulged in this digital world. Just wake up. There's a real world as well. We'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about the importance and ways to detach your children from the digital world and engage them in the environment to develop a relationship with the environment.
Exactly. Yes, as I said, we want to divert their attention from this fantasy world. We need to give them an outlet. We need to gradually, gently make them think of the essence of these things.
Okay.
I mean, you make them realize that you're engrossed, you're engaged in using this technology. Why don't you build it? Why don't you make it? People like you have done it.
Yeah.
Just recently I was visiting a friend of mine, and I saw that in his garage, in the parking, he had allowed his children to old bicycles, even motorcycles. They had broken, torn them apart, disassembled them.
Okay.
And they were assembling them again. And they were changing the fuel from petrol to electricity, putting a battery.
Okay.
I mean, he was allowing his small children
to be constructive.
To become, yes, to learn how to make things,
yes.
To develop things.
Yeah.
Developing their technological skills. So through these, we need to provide them opportunities. For example, there's an application you can, sky map.
Yeah.
Look at the stars in it, and then take the child out into the night sky. And try to find the various constellations that are there.
Yeah.
You have to engage with your child. You have to be, you can't just leave him at the mercy of it.
Yeah.
But you can, you have to work with him
or her. To monitor, to supervise,
to supervise,
ask
him, to help, to assist, to facilitate,
analyze.
To channelize in the right direction. Even from this, we can make a better solution, find a better solution through this very engagement that the child is. The problem is with us, because we want us ourselves to be
free
and relieved of the stress and burden of managing a
parenting.
Child. That is our problem, and that is what's happening.
And child, we have to remember, is amana, is a trust
exactly.
from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and we cannot just leave him on the mercy of this mobile
exactly.
phone.
So we need to help him construct his, we need to help him in constructing in his cognitive abilities. We need to make him understand and develop his mental level.
Yeah.
Intellectual level, cognition. Yeah. We need to help him control his feelings and emotions, and we need him to develop his skills.
And even if he's using if he's involved in the digital world, we need to teach him how to analyze things,
exactly.
how to be constructive.
I mean, nowadays there are so many programs, applications. Teach your child mathematics. Teach your child, for example, science. You can divert his attention to
languages. Yeah. We can talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Imam Kadhim alayhi salam said, "It is a recommended practice for a child to play in his childhood, so that he becomes patient in his adulthood."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We have Professor Salman Naqvi with us, and we're discussing about the ways to develop relationship with the environment. As you mentioned in the previous episodes, I liked those things that you said. Provide alternatives to your children. Something could be trekking, going out for gardening, Do we have some more examples like that? What else we can teach our children to get detached from this digital world and live more in a real world and develop a better relationship with the environment, explore more in the environment?
Number one, I think we should get our child engaged in helping in at home.
Yeah.
Developing skills to manage the home. Ask him or her to help you make food, make iron the clothes, wash the clothes, wash dishes. I mean, engagement in physical activities.
True.
And number two, giving him or her the opportunity to experience creativity and technological skills, taking them the children out into the wild, into nature.
Yeah.
And more than that, I think we need to provide short courses or some non-formal education in the form of group visits.
Yeah.
Taking our children on, not ourselves, he or she should be able to learn how to live in a community, how to engage and interact with other children for sports activities, for learning activities, discovering nature, going out. For example, I remember once when I was a child, my school took me out for outings. Unfortunately, in the third world countries, that's not possible.
True.
But school in the West and many other organizations like scouting, they used to take children out on trips, on visits, on sports events, collective activities, engaging with other people. Even that would teach us how to live in a community. There are so many things which have to be done and to be developed in our societies where we can make our children active, make our children engaged with each other. Nowadays, the situation is so bad. Two siblings sitting together. One is has taken the mobile phone of his father. The other is taken the mobile phone of his mother.
They're engaged in their own world. Parents are engaged in their own world.
So that is the problem. We have to create events. We have to manage, come down together as parents to think over how to manage these things. In a family, you have brothers and sisters who are married. You have families. Work together on how to develop events and programs to get our children to
involved in the environmental activities. Yeah. Thank you so much, Professor Nakavi, for being with us. We came to the conclusion that you need to, even if you want to detach your children from the digital world, you definitely need to provide an alternative, especially the environmental ones. You can take out them for trekking, you can take out them for camping, you can take out them to jungles, for outings, to explore nature, to research more. As Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says four times in Quran, why don't you go for tadabbur? Why don't you contemplate? Thank you so much, dear listeners, for being with us. That was all for today. Inshallah, until another session, fi amanallah, and God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is IRIB English Radio.